Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. St. Louis baseball fans might find it easier to look back at the team's glory days rather than at what happened this week in Chicago. So let's do that. Former St. Louis Cardinal pitcher Bob Gibson has a special place in the hearts of St. Louis fans. He's a 9-time All-Star pitcher who won 2 Cy Young Awards, was the 1968 Most Valuable Player, and pitched on 2 World Championship teams during his 17 seasons with the Cardinals. He had 251 wins and more than 3,100 strikeouts. He is, of course, a member of baseball's Hall of Fame. His 17 strikeouts in the first game of the 1968 World Series is a record that still stands. His new book, Pitch by Pitch, details that game. Although Gibson shut out Detroit to win Game 1, the Cardinals and Gibson lost Game 7 in the series to Mickey Lolich. I talked with Gibson before this year's Cardinal playoff run, and I asked why, with all of his accomplishments, he chose to focus on this one game.
The World Series is probably the most important time of anybody's career, not just that year, but anybody's career. And that's what you aim for at the beginning of the season, to get into the World Series. And to have that and pitch one of the best games of your entire career at the time when it was the most important, I thought it was just nice to tell that story.
But you didn't realize during the course of the game the importance with regard to the strikeout record. You weren't even keeping count, but everybody else apparently was.
Yeah, the strikeouts weren't that important to me at the time. I think probably it's a little nicer now than it was then. But that's not what you really aim for. What you aim for is to win the ball game. And I was about to win the ball game, and that was a little more important. And I always liked to pitch. I didn't like to waste a lot of time. And when Tim came running out behind home plate, I had to stop. And that I was driving me crazy. Let's go. Let's go. Let's get it over with.
This was when you tied Koufax's record.
That's when,
right?
I tied Koufax, number 15.
Right. And you went on to pitch 2 more strikeouts.
2 more, yes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'd like to, in as much as we're in the playoff season now, I'd like to get some sense from you as to what the mindset is like of a ball player reaching the postseason plateau. It's got to be different, and yet you can't let it carry you away.
Well, you try for it not to be different. When you go into the game, the day before the game, the week before the game, whatever it is, before the most important time of your life, you say to yourself, you know, this is just another game, and I'm going to be cool and relaxed and whatever thing else. And you probably are up until the time you get on the mound, the lights go out, or if in the nighttime they start playing the national anthem or what have you, and you get a high that you just can't really explain. It's your stomach jumps a little bit, you know. And as soon as you throw the first pitch, though, you settle down. But it's really exciting, and I don't know that you can explain it unless you're just there and it happens to you. Because if you would see me from sitting in the stands or standing behind me, you think, oh, he's fine. And I was fine, but inside I was jumping up and down.
You know? Well, you point out in the book that it was not uncommon for you before games to take a little bit of a nap.
Yes.
Did you do that before this game?
I may have. I can't remember. But what happens is you come in early, you have batting practice, and you take batting practice at home before the other team. And we have a lot of time to kill. And I go in and our trainer would massage my arm. Sometimes he'd get the wrong arm. He would massage my arm, and you just kind of get relaxed. And I would wake up with a towel over me and everything else. I'd fall asleep. And I didn't do it on purpose. It just happened.
It's really hard to imagine being that relaxed, but I'm sure that served you well on the mound, as the record would indicate. This World Series that you write about in Pitch by Pitch was before the format changed, the postseason format changed. And I know, according to what you say in the book, you're not real happy with the new
format. Well, I'm not a fan of it, no. Yeah. I think, just like the Cardinals this year, I think when you win 100 games or close to it, you're the best team in either league. You deserve to go to the World Series. And I know it's more exciting for the fans to have a team that possibly wouldn't be in the World Series if it hadn't been for the playoffs or the what have you. You know, it's great for the fans, but when I win more games than anybody else, I think I deserve a chance to go to the World Series.
Did you think the mindset for the current players is as it was when you were pitching?
No. No, the mindset is not. I don't think the mindset of the average young person is the same as it was when the kids today, and I hope they don't send me a bunch of nasty letters, but I think they feel entitled. And a lot of these ball players, they act as though they invented the game, that there was nobody before them. And a lot of them are not even aware of what happened before.
You know, you point that out in the book, and I've observed that too, that you know, a lot of players don't know who Jackie Robinson was.
No, we had one right here in St. Louis. I'm not going to say his name, but we had a player, black player, that did not know who Jackie Robinson was.
I find that so hard to understand and even believe. But yeah. We hear and we read that all the time. And it's mm-hmm. it's not only Jackie Robinson. There are others who have played, have made tremendous records in the game, and they don't know.
Yeah.
What about this notion of the players now wearing three-piece suits and carrying briefcases and so
on? Oh, I don't mind that. I tell you what, at one point I was named one of the 10 best-dressed athletes by GQ, so I can understand that myself.
Well, it's fine if they dress like that. The point is that they're businessmen now rather than ball players.
I think they've always been businessmen, and I know that there's a feeling that they wish that players felt more like wanting to be with a certain organization for their eternity, but it's always been about making money. Mm-hmm. Even when I was playing, I wanted to do good for my family. And did I enjoy playing baseball? Absolutely. But my idea was to make as much money as I could. And I stayed here in St. Louis for 17 years, but I had no choice. We didn't have free agency. I don't know if I would have stayed here.
Well, your roommate was Curt Flood, and he ultimately changed everything. He was certainly thinking about money.
Yes. Yes, we all were. Mm-hmm. You know, and I told him when he says, "Hey, Roomie, I'm going to sue baseball, and this is the reason why. And what do you think?" And I says, "You know, Curt, I'm with you 100%, but I'll be about 10 or 12 steps behind you." And I just kind of chuckled.
Yeah. So you didn't get involved in
that? I did not. I did not. I knew what he felt, but I was more concerned about my livelihood and supporting my family. And certainly when you do something like that, you're going to be put on a list. They're going to throw darts at you, and your career is over. And I didn't want that to happen to me.
He really, of course, he didn't survive to see all of the changes that would take place, but he really had a very tragic last third of his life, didn't he?
Yes, he did. He had a hard time. He drank a lot, and when I was his roommate and we played, he very seldom had a drink. It was just, it changed. And I don't know that I can say it was sad. It was just the way his life turned, and that happens to a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, it's too bad that he didn't survive to see, as I said,
yes, he would have loved
those
it.
Other changes. You, the people you write about that you seem to admire and really enjoy the most are Tim McCarver, Roger Maris, Mike Shannon. Give me a little synopsis.
Joe Torre.
Joe Torre also, yeah, but sure, just give me a little thumbnail of what about these people was special to you. Start with McCarver.
Well, McCarver started out as a problem as far as the race was concerned. Mm-hmm. And to see him go from who he was to who he became was just wonderful. And not just him, though. You know, I did a lot of growing up myself mm-hmm. because I was ready to – I was very combative, and when I thought that somebody was not treating me well, you know, we might have a fight on your mm-hmm. hand. And he turned out to be a wonderful individual. I adore him. I talked to him just day before yesterday. Joe's probably one of my best friends. We've done things together. We've had Thanksgiving and Christmas, and we just – his family, in fact kind of treat me as a member of their family, and it's just been wonderful. Of course, my best friend was Curt, and unfortunately, he wasn't around. you know, to see all of this stuff going on. Another guy that I admire, and he could be a part of my family, is Bill White. Just a wonderful guy, you know. And they talk about me having kind of an attitude. Bill had a terrible attitude. He calls me the meanest man in the world. And I said, yeah, right behind you.
Well, I've interviewed here on this program as well. And he's lost a lot of that. He was an absolutely charming guy. And he went on to do great things post-baseball career.
Yeah. He's still pretty good. Right now, he just wants to fish. I talked him into buying a motorhome because I have a motorhome. I enjoy that. And I drove around with him for some time, but he started running into things, so he sold his motorhome.
Coming up, more of my conversation with Hall of Fame pitcher Bob Gibson. His new book is called Pitch by Pitch, My View of One Unforgettable Game. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. Now back to more of my conversation with St. Louis Cardinals Hall of Fame pitcher Bob Gibson. I continued by asking him about teammates he admired, including Mike Shannon and Roger Maris.
Roger Maris, I heard a lot of horror stories about Roger Maris when he was with the Yankees, and he was nothing like what you read or heard. He was laid back. He was very quiet. He was probably one of the best baseball players that I ever saw. You know, he'll go down in history as hitting 60 home runs and going for the record, but nobody really got to know. He was one of the best ball players. Never made mistakes. You didn't see him make errors. Never made mental mistakes. Yeah, guys would drop a ball. Never threw to the wrong base. Just outstanding player.
He was got a bad rap, I think, in New York because the Mickey Mantle was such a favorite there, and they thought that there was some sort of a grudge thing going on.
Yeah, well, in New York, they like to go and dig in stuff and bring out something that's not really true.
How about Shannon?
Shannon was a little different than everybody. I like Shannon because
and still is.
Yeah, I like Mike because he was different. He was I thought he was nuts, and I kind of like people that are nuts. And we kind of hung out together, not a lot, but a little bit. And I think I probably hang out more with him more now than I did when we played.
What made that 68 team so special? I mean, we talked about a number of the players, but obviously there has to be some sort of a chemistry to make it all work.
Well, there is a chemistry. And if you look back at each individual, there are several players off of that ball club that became better individuals than baseball players after they got through playing. You'll see several guys that went into broadcasting. You see people who was in the managerial part of baseball. I think in order to be a good ball player, you have to have a little bit more than physical talent. And I think these guys all had something a little special.
I guess that one folds over on the other, doesn't it? If you're talented and have great ability in one area, there's absolutely no reason why you shouldn't have extraordinary abilities in others.
Well, I guess that's easy to say. I'm not sure that always happened. Some people just aren't capable. You'll find a lot of good athletes that are not capable of doing something outside of the game. But I think you have to give the Cardinals credit, because they have always been able to put a team together that has not only had talent but had other things. And you look at that team that they have right now, and I don't think that's the most talented baseball team in baseball. However, they're the winningest team in baseball, and that means something.
Well, a lot of credit has to be given to the manager, Mike Matheny, too, don't you think? I mean, given the season and the injuries and all that he's had this year.
Yeah, the manager, the general manager, I think putting the team together – is probably more important than manage it on a field. And when we have a problem, and I say we because I'm still involved with the team, when we have a problem on a field, the management goes into the minor leagues. They bring up some kids that do a wonderful job, or they go out and make a trade and make a deal. And we've gotten a lot of players from somewhere else, and they weren't necessarily stars on the other teams. They were good guys that fit right in with the ball club.
Well, what is your association with the team these days?
I call myself a celebrity coach. I don't do anything. They have parties, and I attend the parties. I like to have a little cocktail every once in a while. But for a while, I was going to spring training. Every spring, I would spend the entire time down there, not necessarily coaching, but being available just in case some of the guys want to ask me some questions, just to be there. And now it's pretty much the same, but I don't go down to spring training that often. I've got a few years behind me, and it gets a little bit tough. I've had a couple of knees replaced, and right now I need an ankle replaced, but I'm not going to get it done. But just being around. And one thing the Cardinals are good for is keeping some of the old guys around and letting the young players ask questions or just to see who they are. And the Cardinals are outstanding with that.
But not all of the older players, I would think, are willing to do that. Or are they, generally?
I think most of them would be if they were asked. Our organization will ask. There's a lot of organizations that won't do that. I think we are probably the best, maybe along with the Yankees or the Dodgers. But you hear about us because that's what they do.
You know, one of the things we've heard a lot recently, and much of it has been criticism of, quote, the Cardinal way. People outside of St. Louis think, who do they think they are if there's a Cardinal way? What are your thoughts on that?
The Cardinal way is winning. And when you win a lot, it's easy to put that tag on you, that Cardinal way. I don't think there's anything significant about that. It's just that the organization had been good enough to put a winning team on for years and years, and it keeps happening. And is there some magical thing? I don't think so.
You know, we're recording this before any of the games against Chicago have been played. This is kind of a dream series, I think, for most of the fans. How do you look at them? Is it a great rivalry, and here they are for the first time against each other in the postseason?
Well, the rivalry, as far as I'm concerned, is with the fans, not the players. We don't, you know, all we want to do is get to the finals. We want to get into the playoffs and get to the World Series. And if we have to play the Cubs, fine. I think because Chicago's only 300 miles away, you hear a lot of that. And I think any two ball clubs that are close together, you'll hear about that rivalry. Maybe it's because the fans in St. Louis and the fans in Chicago with 300 miles, they all get in their car or they come and they're here. And you see them all the time. But I don't think that the players really feel that. You want to beat the Cubs? Oh, yeah, kill them. You know, yeah. But so we would want to beat anybody like that.
It's kind of fun to look in the stands when they play each other and see perhaps a husband and a wife or a boyfriend and a girlfriend wearing Cardinals and Cubs jerseys.
Yeah, well, they were one I have Cardinals on, the other one I have the Cubs on. It's just strange.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about, it's intriguing to me and it's to a lot of people, and that is the fact that Bob Gibson was always known as extremely intimidating as a ball player. And I wanted your thoughts on that because I wonder how well that works on the field and if it's another weapon, another tool in your toolkit. Another one I think of who was able to do that effectively up until recently is Tiger Woods. There's just something about being there that intimidated the opposition.
Well, the intimidation, as far as I'm concerned, is not me intimidating you. It's you being intimidated by me. I think it's within the beholder of what's going on, because my idea was not to intimidate. My idea was to win and to be good at what I did. Same with Tiger. He was good at what he did. And whenever he was like two strokes behind, you guys were looking over their shoulder. And I'm glad it worked out that way. I'm glad they were intimidated by me, but that really wasn't what I was trying to do. All I was trying to do was win. Now, my personality happens to be the type of personality that I didn't smile a lot. I didn't talk a lot to people on the other teams, and maybe that's intimidating. Well, so be it. But it wasn't something I sat home and thought about. I think today I'm going to go out and growl at somebody. And I probably did growl, but it wasn't something that I wanted to do. It was just the way I was.
But were you aware that it was happening?
I wasn't aware until after my career. You know, people say, well, you did this and you did that. And I hear stories. I hear stories that are bigger now than they were when I was playing. I heard once that Mike Schmidt, he happened to hit his first major league home run off of me. And I went over to third base, and as he rounded third base, I straddled the line and made him run around me. Now, that's the story. Now, I asked him one day, and this is after he got into the Hall of Fame, and we were sitting talking. I said, what about that me straddling the line and making you run around? I said, did you see it that way? He says, no. What happened, I hit the home run, and he says, out of respect for you, I didn't know whether to run in front of you or behind you, so I took a couple of slow steps until you passed me, because it happened to be the home run to win the ballgame is in Philadelphia. And that's the true story.
Do you remember a lot of the home runs hit off of you?
Oh, I remember some, yeah. There were so many hit that you can't, there's no way you can remember all of them, but the ones that really hurt you badly, you remember a lot of those.
Which one comes to mind is perhaps the one that you remember most vividly?
The one I remember most vividly is the last home run hit off of me. I never threw another pitch after that.
And
it
was
happened to be with against the Chicago Cubs. Pete LeCocq.
Pete LeCocq.
I was coming out of the bullpen. Red put me in the bullpen the last week and a half or two. I wasn't pitching at all. They wanted the young kids to pitch. And I made a huge mistake by telling the organization at the beginning of the season that this was going to be my last season. If I had to do it all over again, I would never do that. But when I told them that I was going to quit, then they start easing up on letting me start, and they start pitching the kids. So I came in down in Houston. I'll remember this. And it was about 10 days or 12 days left in the season. And Red says, we're out of pitchers. Would you pitch the 10th inning against Houston? And I said, yeah, I'll pitch. So I came out of the bullpen in the 11th, and I struck out three guys with nine pitches, nine fastballs. Didn't try to throw anything else. And Red says, 2 days, 3 days later, I pitched in Pittsburgh, and I pitched five innings in relief. And then 2 days later, he brought me in here in St. Louis. I came in with the bases loaded, Pete LeCocq hitting, and he hit a home run. The ball game was over after that. We did hit in the bottom half of the inning, but when I walked off of the mound, I went in to the clubhouse, took a shower, and went home. And that was it.
I'm talking with Cardinals Hall of Fame pitcher Bob Gibson. Gibson, who was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 1981, played 17 seasons for the Cardinals from 1959 to 1975. And he's written a new book called Pitch by Pitch, My View of One Unforgettable Game. It's an account of Game 1 of the 1968 World Series. More in just a few minutes. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. Now, more of my conversation with Hall of Fame pitcher Bob Gibson, whose book is called Pitch by Pitch, My View of One Unforgettable Game, a new book. It's an account of Gibson's shutout in Game 1 of the 1968 World Series. I spoke with him last week and continued by asking him about his pitching in the 64 and 68 World Series, specifically about the fact that he made three starts during each of those series, going the full nine innings for all of the games played.
That's the way we played back in those days. You weren't looking to have a setup man and then the closer. If you could go nine, you went nine. And it wasn't just me. Most of the pitchers did that. Today, it's very difficult. It's phenomenal to see a guy go nine innings, and everybody talks about it, because it's not the pitcher's fault that they don't go nine. That's just the way they play the game. They look to bring in the setup man and then the closer, and that's what they get paid to do. But if they had to do it, I'm sure guys could pitch longer.
Well, you threw 143 pitches, I think, in game that the book Pitch by Pitch is all about. That's a lot of pitches. Nobody's throwing that many pitches today.
No, I averaged 131 pitches. That was my average. I threw just a few more pitches than my average.
Well, and you talk about the setup guys and the fact that they've changed all that. Does it make it a better game?
I don't know that it makes it better or worse. Yeah. It's just the way they do it today. You know, if I were pitching today, I probably would be used to pitching 7 innings or 8 innings. Mm-hmm. Or how about this, having a quality start, whatever that means.
Another thing that I learned from your book that I never heard before that I find quite fascinating is the fact that you have what you call symmetrical fingers, and that this somehow may have helped you on the mound.
Oh, well, now, Tim McCarver is the one who coined that phrase. I don't know what that means. My fingers are shaped, you know, like the two front ones are about the same size and the two small ones are the same size.
They're symmetrical, my God.
Yeah, and he saw that and he said, well, that's got to be the reason your ball moves so much. You have to blame Tim for that.
You you make many references to Harry Carey in your book. You're smiling. I guess you know where I'm going. I don't think you like the guy very much.
Oh, I liked Harry.
Really?
I absolutely did like Harry. But I wasn't afraid of Harry. And Harry, one day he says, he says, Bob, would you run out and get, who was it, Tracy Stollard. Tracy Stollard had pitched a really good ball game. Well, it just so happens the game before that, he didn't pitch well. He got knocked out in the first inning, and Harry Carey said something like, well, I saw him last night down in Gaslight Square, so that's probably the reason he didn't do so well. So now we were in Chicago again, and Tracy had pitched a shutout or something like that. And he says, Bob, would you run and get Tracy? So I went out, and I couldn't wait. I ran all the way because I knew Tracy wouldn't come in. I said, Harry wants you on his show. And Tracy says, I'm not going on his show. So I go back. I said, Harry, Tracy won't come. And so Harry says, blankety blank blank, I don't know what's so wrong with these guys. And I said, Harry, you really don't talk very well about the players. You say things about them on the air, and it makes them unhappy. He says, well, I don't know what you're talking about, Bob. I'd never hurt you. I said, the only way you could hurt me is that you had a bat and you were a pretty good fastball hitter. But I would say things like that to him. But we would go out and have drinks together.
How aware are players of what is said in the broadcast booths? Obviously, you're not listening to the game or watching it, but somehow the word gets back to you guys, I think.
One of your friends will tell you, oh, I heard somebody say this. And it's not necessarily true. Because I remember one day when Ted Simmons approached me and said, my friend said that you were talking about me on air. I said, Ted, if I had something to say to you or about you, I most certainly would say it to you, not on air, which I never talk about players on air. But your friends will tell you that either somebody said this or that, or they complimented you, or they were getting on your case. And so that's how you pretty much knew.
On the other hand, they can really help a ball player and help a ball club. And St. Louis has really been very, very lucky with the Harry Careys of the world and the Jack Bucks, and there are others that come to mind that have, you know, really helped make a team. That's the impression. It's the look and the eyes through which many fans see the ball players and see the game.
Well, they can help as far as generating popularity. As far as the team is concerned, they can't help make a good ball club. You got a good ball club or you don't. And if you have a bad club, they're not going to say anything good. If you have a good club, they can't say anything bad.
But they can help bring fans into the ballpark.
They help bring the fans.
And that can help the ball club, right?
Yeah. Well, in that case, yes.
Yeah. Another story that you tell in the book, Bob Gibson, is of your well-known as a really pretty good basketball player, one who played for the Harlem Globetrotters and could have gone into collegiate ball and professional ball, I should say.
I tried to get in out of Creighton, and I sent in the questionnaires or what have you. Or my coach talked to him, and Tommy Thompson, he was my basketball coach at Creighton, and called me in his office one day after practice and says, you know, I got a letter back from Indiana, and you won't be getting a scholarship there. I'm sorry, I don't mean college. It was high school, mm-hmm. Neil Mosser. And I said, well, why not? And he says, well, they had their quota. I says, quota of what? Of black. I mean, they didn't call us black then. They just say Negroes or whatever it was, the terminology. And I said, well, how many did they have? And he said, one. And so later on, I was watching them play, and I said, oh, they made a mistake. They got the wrong one.
Who was that one?
I don't remember his name.
How much of that sort of thing did you run into?
Oh, it was their day in and day out. Yeah. And I'm sure if you know, when you look for trouble, you find it. If I were to go out right now and look, I probably wouldn't have to go too far. It's there. But I think people are a little more sophisticated now, and I'm glad they are. If you got something to say about me and my race, I'm glad you keep it to yourself. Yeah.
Well, of course, we've been talking about a lot here over the last year or so, given the Ferguson situation. You're still living in Omaha?
I do.
Did you watch that with and if you did, I assume, as most people did, watch what was going on. What were your thoughts? I mean, this is your former home, your former place of business, if you will.
Yeah, I didn't have a lot. It wasn't anything that surprised me. Yeah. But, you know, when you're watching stuff on television, I'm not sure what I'm looking at, because I know that things can be, as far as the TV station is concerned, they can kind of show whatever they want in whatever light they want. And I know that because it's happened to me. So, first of all, I have to really find out what the heck happened. What happened? I know what's capable of happening, but I don't know for certain. You know, and I have yet to figure out how the police can get away with some of the stuff they do and just saying it was in the line of duty. I remember once. And it wasn't like Ferguson, but I like to drive a motorhome. That's what I do. August Bush gave me a motorhome when I retired. Mm-hmm. And I was driving through California with Gene Gieselman, who was the trainer for the Cardinals, and his girlfriend and me and my girlfriend. And there was a cop just following us. He got behind the motorhome. He just followed us. And after about 10 minutes or so, he pulled me over. And I got out and asking what was wrong. He says, I noticed that you only have one license plate, and it's on the back, it's not on the front. I said, well, I'm from Nebraska, and it doesn't require two, it's just one. And on the front, I had a license plate that had two cardinals on it. And I thought, why is this guy stopping me? Mm-hmm. Why is he stopping me? And the only thing I could come up with was harassment, period.
We've heard that story a lot over the last year.
And it's capable. I mean, it will happen. I've had several things. When I won the MVP of the World Series in 1964, and that's before they had the interstates finish here, I was driving to Omaha, and I was going through one of those little small towns in Missouri. A guy pulled me over and said that he had a report that somebody had stolen a car just like that. The Corvette that they gave me for winning the MVP of the World Series, pulled me over and lied about what he heard. He just wanted to see.
Did either of these officers know who you were?
No. Yeah. No.
Did you tell them?
No. The one guy, there's a guy in the motorhome never did, but this one guy figured it out. You know, I didn't have any license plate, but I did have papers. And where do you get this car? I won it. You won it. Yeah. How'd you do that? And I said, well, I won it in the World Series. And then he looked and he puzzled. He said, I said, that's right. And he says, could I have? I said, no, you can't have anything. If you're through with me, I got to go. But see, those kinds of things happen. So I'm not surprised.
But they're still happening.
They still happen. Yeah. Absolutely. It still happens. And so, but I don't know. Sometimes some of the guys do some things to cause some problems. And I say some of the guys, some black people do things to cause problems with the police. Some don't. I would imagine the majority don't. But to see it happen is not surprising.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that Ferguson brought to the fore was the economic situation, the fact that so many poor people and poor black people are pulled over just under the kind of conditions that you describe. They're hauled into court. They're fined excessively. If they don't have the money, they're thrown in jail.
Right.
This caught a lot of people here by surprise, but this was really nothing new.
No, it's nothing new. You know, I could tell you story after story that has happened to me and for no reason, no apparent reason other than being black. I had an incident in Omaha where I used to work at the License Bureau. When we started playing, you couldn't just play baseball. You had to have a winter job. Mm-hmm. And I worked at the License Bureau. And my job was to, when people rode in and wanted to get their new license plates for their car, rather than to come in, they just sent a letter. And I saw this license plate that had four zeros. I said, man, that's really a nice place. So I got another plate and sent it back to him. Oh, he raised heck. Now when we got into the series in 64 and we won it, the license bureau in Omaha, they made a plate, special plate, had six zeros. And I was driving this nice car. Cop pulled me over. What are you doing with that license plate? It's on my car. Well, we don't have a plate like that. Yes, we do. So he called in, and he found out who it belonged to, and now he was nice, only it was too late. Yeah. I didn't want to hear it.
Bitter? You carry bitterness with you?
Sometimes.
Over all of this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm better now, you know, and that comes with age, though. I can talk about it. 50 years ago, I wouldn't have been sitting here talking. I wouldn't have about it.
You talk to young people about it?
No, I don't.
Why?
No, I'm not good at talking to young people. I want to kill them. Young people. Well, young people don't want to listen. Today, they're different, entirely different than we were when we were kids. And some of the stuff that we had to abide by, they don't think it doesn't apply to them. And I'm not really good at going around talking to young people. And there are other people who are good at it. So let them do it. That's why I say it.
Let me just take us back to 1968 for a moment. 68 in itself was a heck of a year. Many things happened, not the least of which was the assassination of Dr. King, Bobby Kennedy. There was a Democratic convention, a lot of stuff going on, and a lot of action in the streets, particularly following the assassination of Dr. King. How are you able to concentrate on what you do every day, how you earn your daily living with all of this going on around? And when I'm assuming that you would leave the ballpark and you couldn't necessarily stay in the hotel you wanted to stay at, it, even in those days, you might not have been able to go to the restaurants you would have liked to have gone to. How do you maintain the concentration to play ball and live in that kind of an environment?
Well, I think most professional players have the ability to put that stuff to the side while they're playing. I certainly had the ability to do that. And I did it affect me? Absolutely. But it did not affect me on the field. Once the game was over and then you go back to reality, then it affected me a lot. But for those 2 hours, 2.5 hours, it only used to be 2.5 hours, it did not affect me. I was able to put it aside. And I would assume that there are a lot of guys who are like that.
Yeah, I was going to ask if you think you were an exception to that.
No, I don't think so.
In your day.
I don't think so.
Well, let me ask you a final question. Just look back. Is there a moment, and it's been a long time now. We're talking pitch by pitch. It's 47 years ago, the 1968 World Series. You look back. Is there a moment, Bob Gibson, that you'll never forget, that you treasure as part of the Gibson history?
Probably the day that Johnny Keene took over as manager of the Cardinals. And he called me in his office and he said, Bob, you're going to pitch every fifth day, win or lose. He says, you have a long way to go to learn how to pitch. And he says, you're going to learn how to pitch right here. And I'm going to make sure you have that opportunity.
Well, thank goodness that he gave you that opportunity and you took the advantage of it. You did, Bob Gibson. Your book is a wonderful story. It's a great read. I enjoyed it, recommend it. And I know a lot of people will enjoy it as well.
Thank you.
That's Hall of Fame pitcher Bob Gibson. We'll be back tomorrow with more. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.